You're listening to the Autism Weekly Podcast. Each week, we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week, we're joined by Jared Van, a PhD student at the Pennsylvania State University, specializing in special education. With a background in behavior analysis and extensive experience working with autistic children, Jared brings valuable insight into precision teaching. Join us as we discuss the benefits and future potential of precision teaching for children with autism and their families. Welcome to the podcast, Jared.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. And this is a topic I don't know that in the ABA field we talk enough about because it's got a lot of value. But before we go there, one of the things I really love to be able to do is to give a little bit of a background and almost kind of give the flavor to our audience of where somebody's coming from and what brought their passion to the field. So you work with the special ed community and have applied this with autistic individuals. So where did that passion come from? What drove you into the research into precision teaching?
Well, when I graduated from undergrad in California from University Stockton, dang, I'm forgetting, it's been so long, but from UOP, University of the Pacific, I graduated as a psychology major, and all I can do with that degree was be a behavior therapist. That's what they called it at the time, which ironically, Ogden Lindsley, the founder of precision teaching, coined the term behavior therapist. And I became a behavior therapist and I started working with people in homes and at schools. And I realized, and I knew this before, I'm just a big kid. I love to have fun and I love to learn. And when I was a kid, I didn't like school, but being able to work with other kids with autism and with other developmental disabilities, to be able to go to class and then it's like, okay, just hurry up and finish this and we can go out and play. We can go have the fun thing first then. And I really became good at being able to work with these clients. And I learned, hey, I'm doing pretty well, but I think I need to learn more to be able to do better. So I went off and got my master's in applied behavior analysis at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology at the LA campus. And I just really fell in love then with precision teaching. And the whole time I've really enjoyed being, I call it like in the trenches, actually working with the people and with the learners, because I never wanted to be a supervisor where I'm kind of dealing with paperwork. I just really enjoy seeing the growth of our learners and our kids over time.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of our passion stems from. And ironically, is that I think I started almost the same route that you did. I went through psychology, was a behavior therapist at that time as well, because that's what it was labeled as. And then went back into kind of furthering my degree in psychology and behavior analysis. So it's like we walked the same path. But when you're trying to describe precision teaching, because I think this is where, you know, families might not fully grasp, and the education system is still trying to understand how to apply it. When you're describing that to somebody for the first time, what are the key components that you hone in on to help them realize that this is a science that really could benefit a variety of children?
You know, one of the components I hone in on is the way that we detect and describe behavior. In behavior analysis, a lot of people use operational definitions. They can be super long. They can have multiple behaviors. There's no formula as to how to create them. But in precision teaching, we use this thing called a Pinpoint Plus, which has a formula for how to create it. It's very simple. It's very short. And it's easily detectable by any individual who reads it. So that's one. We're detecting behaviors more precisely so that we can better be able to measure them. Then we use this really weird chart called the standard acceleration chart so that we can measure behavior and we detect the speed at which somebody is learning. And this is important because when you use other charts that are not standardized, you can't measure the rate of learning. You don't know how fast someone's learning. And oftentimes at the bottom of the line, it says sessions. And I always, you know, kind of cringe when I see sessions because that's not a real unit of time. Like What if two sessions are the same, are different amounts of time? Is every session every day? What if you miss a day? Then it's not really a time series graph. So it's really harming our scientific rigor by not using standard metrics to be able to be a natural science like we are. So I tell people that it's really just a system to define and measure behavior in a way that's so precise we can quantify the speed of learning. We can measure how quickly or slowly learners' behaviors are growing or decaying. This is thanks to the engine that drives precision teaching, the standard acceleration chart. And it's a graph or a chart that all precision teachers use that can measure behaviors ranging from once per day to 1,000 per minute. And I would say that if you're measuring behavior on the standard, or if you're not measuring behavior on a standard acceleration chart, then you're not precision teaching. So you got to use the chart.
Yeah. And I mean, when you say the word standard, the acceleration chart, I can almost watch every student out there be like, ah, I mean, yeah. It's one of those challenges as you're going through mm-hmm. your program where you really have to grasp concepts. You have to be able to really look at and evaluate it the right way to understand it well, but it's got so much value. I mean, we want to see rapid growth in learning. We want to see how quickly we're able to get to the use of a new mm-hmm. skill. And I think that to me hits, at least when you're talking about precision teaching, and maybe you can kind of guide me a little bit on this, but I look at it almost as a effort and consistency over the perfection of the skill. It's like, are we seeing more practice of it versus is this done to a preciseness every single time? Is that kind of part of the process of precision teaching, or is it more that you do need that precise answer and it's not about the effort that goes in, that you're seeing more and more tries at getting there?
Well, are you talking about the learner or are you talking about the person who's measuring the behavior?
I'm looking at the learner and their okay. effort through the process.
Yeah. So when it comes to their effort, we're looking at where they're starting. So the cool thing about the standard acceleration chart is it shows that every learner starts at different spots, just like we already know, and that growth is relative to previous growth. You can't get that on a regular graph. So what it does is it helps us understand, hey, with precision teaching, you can use any instructional method, any intervention, but you're using this to measure it, that intervention or instructional method. And you're saying, hey, is this instructional method that I'm using helping my learner learn? And are they learning fast enough? Because those graphs are supposed to help us make database decisions. If you're taking too long to make a database decision, or if it's going to take the learner months to learn one behavior, then you're wasting a lot of instructional time and leaving a lot of data on the table. So as practitioners, I think that it would behoove us to be able to support our learners and advocate for them with the best measurement systems we have. And this way we can be like, oh, well, my teaching, my intervention is not exactly getting them where we want to go, so let's tweak it a little bit and see if we can help them more. Or, oh my God, their growth is so great. The great thing we could see is all these numbers that describe what's going on, and we keep on going. When you don't use the standard acceleration chart, you really don't know. And because of the way the axes are scaled, you're making assumptions based on that scaling of that axis. It's like, why did you scale it like that? Like, for what reason? What scientific purpose? Is it just because it fit on the graph, or is it because there is a scientific reason?
No, absolutely. And I mean, being able to evaluate that way seems extremely important. So when you're looking at kind of utilizing a precision teaching model versus maybe mm-hmm. some of the basic skill training models that exist out there, like a discrete trial training or verbal behavior mm-hmm. training sort of methodology. How does that differ? I mean, when I think of precision teaching, I'm thinking is that you have a lot more where you're evaluating the motivation of a client to your learner to be able to independently start using the skill more and more frequently. And that's the excitement about it. That's where you get to reinforce more. Are there other things that we should be looking at as far as, you know, why would I choose precision teaching? Mm-hmm. And what are some of the benefits of that that maybe we just don't think about?
That's a great question. One of the things is we want free operants, which is really just saying that the learner is able to engage in the behavior at their own pace. They don't have to wait for somebody else to tell them go, or to tell them do this, now do this, do that, because their responding is contingent upon the teacher telling them what to do when. So you're really not getting what's true behavior, like in the real world, where we kind of just operate. We're free to move around. So what we do in precision teaching is we try to make sure that the learner is free to be able to move as at their own pace, to improve that pace, to make sure that they have the accuracy that they need, to build fluency, which is the fluid combination of accuracy plus speed, which characterizes competent performance. And it's making sure that you're enabling your learner to have the freedom to be able to engage with their environments without so many prompts. I hope that answers your question.
No, it absolutely does. And maybe providing some color to that by looking at it across some of these environments is that maybe you can paint the picture for us, because I see the value of using precision teaching in schools and a special education background for you. I'm sure that you immediately say, yeah, it can be used here. But I also see it in clinics or centers. I see it in the home. I see it in the community. It just takes different forms to be able to utilize it, maybe some creativity. But maybe you can paint a picture, maybe utilize, kind of give us a school scenario where you're seeing it, and maybe a skill, and just paint that kind of that growth.
Absolutely. So I was working with this individual with autism. They were in middle school at the time. And there were two things that I used precision teaching with them on. And I was still early in my precision teaching development. I was doing all the reading and I was trying to learn. The first thing was they always had biology tests that were vocab tests. So they would have to read the words and then fill in the blank with the correct vocabulary word. So what I did with them is I used SAFMED's Say All Fast Minute Everyday Shuffled. And it's basically like flashcards where you look at the card on one side and you see it, and then you say what's on the back. But you're trying to do it quickly because you want to do as many as you can within that minute, and you do it every day. So what I would do with them is I would get the vocabulary term on one side and then the definition on the other. I would show them the definition and they would have to get the term. So they were, I got them going. He was going. And he was really enjoying it, because you want to kind of, they like to see that they improved and they beat their own score. Because it's really just, you know, trying to beat your own score. So it's almost gamified by itself and in itself. So once I got them going and they got to a certain level of performance, I was like, okay, now they have to see the question and write the answer. But we've been seeing and saying, is it going to transfer over? So I gave him a piece of paper and it had the blank, and I let him try. I was like, okay, go for it. Answer the questions. And he was able to do them all so fast. And I was like, wow, this is cool. It transferred over from see say to see write. And that's kind of how we define our learning channels, the way that information comes in, the in channels, and the way the information comes out. The way the information came in was see. The way the information came out was either say or write. And those are some of the most used learning channels in education. Then there was a conundrum that occurred because he went to high school and he got a locker, and he had a lot of books and he needed to be able to use that locker. He's never used a lock before. So I'm like, okay, I got to use some of that creativity. We're saying, how do I teach him how to use a lock? And it was one of those twisty knob turning locks. We had to like spin it clockwise, counterclockwise, and clockwise again.
Jared, so you might have to teach me how to use one of those again too. So I'm going to listen.
No, yeah, it's been a while for me too. But what I did was I gave prompts. So I color coded where he needed to go and turn it to, and then I had him complete it in a certain amount of time. So he had to go to 35, 26, 47, and then he had to go in the correct order and then open it. So it was all these behaviors in one. So I made him learn how to do it to a certain frequency. And then I was like, okay, it works at home. I'm not working with him at the school. I really hope it generalizes to the school. So I was like, Mom, I need you to work with the people at school. Ask them if it works, if he's able to do it at school. They get to school. They come back. They tell me, they're like, Jared, we're not allowed to use this lock on his locker. We have to use a different lock. So he was able to do it, and he was able to actually generalize it to another location, but then I had to train on a different lock, which was fine. It was like a simple turn to the number, and that was fine, and it worked. But I used the frequency building skill, the frequency building intervention, so that when you become fluent in something, it becomes easy, it becomes effortless, it becomes almost automatic within your behavioral repertoire. And there are a lot of benefits with fluency. They say REAPs, retention, endurance, performance standards, and there's stability in the face of distraction. So like, you know, can you read fast? But also if there's like a lawnmower going, can you continue reading? Can you continue talking even if the dog's barking? All of these things require fluency, and there are amazing benefits to building the fluency, but not only in schools. In schools, we only teach the accuracy, which is 100%. We don't also get that fluent pace, you know, that speed that we also need. And then sometimes in behavior analysis, we only teach to accuracy, that 100%. We're not building fluent performers so that they reap the benefits of REAPs.
No, absolutely. And so, ironically, my daughters did 1 year at a charter school where direct instruction was applied, which relies on precision teaching. And those concepts, the stability, endurance, application, retention, was kind of their format. That's what they kind of went through. And I'd be like, how is this going to work? Like, I mean, honestly, are the kids going to get excited? You see the motivation because they're seeing themselves. Oh, can I get it even faster? Can I do it even cleaner? Like, you see that going on. Maybe you can give us a little bit, because as you described all those concepts, one of the things that immediately as a parent or a clinician that I'd be jumping to is, well, if I do teach this way, do I have to teach every single concept this way? Or is the possibility of generalization going to occur where the child can start learning new concepts without me having to go through the rigor of doing precision teaching each time? Or do I utilize it specifically for tasks that need to have that repetition, that frequency with fluency combination that you mentioned?
That's a great question. So we want behaviors, I'm going to use a bunch of terms that people don't often use or know, but we want behaviors to adduce. We want them to be able to engage in same behavior, different environment, or new behavior, novel behavior, novel environment. And sometimes we need to get certain skills, which are like component smaller skills, up into a certain frequency to be able to adduce. Those skills can adduce, and it could be, you know, going in different areas. So sometimes breaking those skills down, it's like, what are the component skills, those little small pieces, those elements that we need to break up, that they need to be fluent in? So then we could just teach those, and then they might be able to adduce, and they may be able to generalize, and they don't need the frequency building for another skill. Sometimes that happens, and we could test for that. But if it doesn't happen, then we kind of go back, okay, well, luckily we have this formula, this, you know, precision teaching, so that we can kind of measure. And a lot of seasoned precision teachers, I am not one of them because I'm still really learning a lot. A lot of seasoned precision teachers will see what they can get without teaching a lot. You know, they'll try to see, okay, can you do this yet? Okay, I'm gonna teach a little bit, but can you do it now? And then, you know what I mean? They kind of test to see, because sometimes you could skip steps because those contingencies adduce.
Yeah. And so that, I guess, goes to some of the, I mean, that was a misconception, obviously, I had, was, you know, the generalization would be something that would be hard to program for. But I mean, you're describing that, you know, this is what it's being done. Are there other misconceptions that people have? Because precision teaching and direct instruction almost had this wave effect. Like, people started really getting into the research on it. It started fading out of kind of more prominent literature. Yeah. And now it's creeping back in again. I mean, so what are the misconceptions that caused the wave to occur?
Well, I think one is precision teaching is not a teaching method. It's best recognized as like a detection and measurement tool of learning that includes access to repeated practice, error correction, and timed drills. And we use the standard acceleration chart. I think that one of the things that turn people off is the standard acceleration chart, because it looks so daunting, but there's so much value in it. In my mind, it's like, imagine if we thought it was hard to conceptualize and understand reinforcement and punishment and the principles of behavior. And we were like, oh, it looks too hard. Let's just not do it. Like, No, they are paramount to our interventions. So I think that kind of in the same vein, the chart, once you learn it from somebody who really knows how to use it, it can really be helpful. And we call that a chart parent. People have chart parents that teach them how to use the chart and engage with it because it is hard to learn. I'm not going to lie. Another thing I think people don't understand about precision teaching is sometimes they think that you could do precision teaching without the chart. No, they're hand in hand. The chart drives the engine that is precision teaching. That's what my advisor and mentor, Dr. Richard Kambita, likes to say. And a lot. One more thing that people think about precision teaching is that everything's just about going fast. All people care about it. All precision teachers want is going fast. And that's the misconception that I understand because we say we want fluency, which is the combination of accuracy plus speed, but it's really pace. What is the pace that this behavior requires? When we talk, if I talk like this, it's going to be annoying and you're not going to want to have a conversation with me because I need a certain level of fluency to be able to have a conversation. Once you hit that, everything kind of becomes easier. And precision teachers recognize that because of the research they've done using the standard acceleration chart and using precision teaching.
Yeah, and I guess there's one other misconception that you started to kind of hit on, I think, that mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have, is the individualization of precision learning, precision teaching. And mm-hmm. kind of you touched on maybe you're using written language to get to oral language to get to, just kind of looking at it that way. And maybe different learners process information differently. And maybe you start at different places. Maybe you're looking at what's going to be most mm-hmm. effective with them. But how else can you individualize precision teaching to make sure that you're taking advantage of the strengths of the learner?
That's a great question. One of the things we always want to know is not only what are their deficits, but what do they excel at? What do individuals excel at? And how can we utilize that to benefit our instructional methods? We want to look into creative and novel ways. One of the ways that it's individualized is the fact that everybody comes from a different learning history. And sometimes some charts don't respect that. Some non-standard charts don't respect that everybody comes from a different learning history. So for me, let's say my math ability is not the greatest. I mean, when it comes to those math fact fluency sheets, I start sweating. I get anxious. I'm like, oh, don't pick me. But that's because of my learning history. I never learned to a certain level of fluency or ability. So what we do is we are able to detect what level somebody starts at and then build their instruction from that. We could be like, oh, okay, if they're at this level, we don't need to do this, we could do this. Or if they're at this level, we definitely need to do this. We're doing error correction. And when we do our error correction procedures, we can see, oh, they omitted this letter, they omitted this word, they skipped over that. Why did they skip a line? Let's practice that. So we see the little minute details and errors, and we're like, okay, well, let's fix that and then see what changes. For instance, we know that oral reading fluency is one of the biggest indicators and predictors of comprehension in reading. So if a reader is focused on being able to sound out the letters and the words, they're not going to be able to retain the information. So what we do is we build that oral reading fluency, and then all of a sudden they're able to understand. And then maybe if they're not able to completely comprehend, we work on prosody and making sure that they're able to say the end of the sentence correctly and all that stuff. And then when they're saying, you know, the exclamation point with excitement, and then, you know, the question marks with upward inflection at the end with prosody, then they're like, oh, now I understand what's going on in this passage. So we kind of are able to pick apart those little things with our error correction procedures.
Would it be fair to say that the concept and the science remains consistent, learner to learner, mm-hmm. but you're looking at expectations, or you're looking at the way that you might be doing the error correction procedure slightly different mm-hmm. based off of knowing those strengths?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that precision teachers say, we have the saying, the learner is always right. It doesn't mean that everything that the learner does is something that we enjoy or we like, but it means that there is a a history of reinforcement and punishment within their behavioral repertoire because of what they went through, and that informs what they do, and the antecedents and the environmental stimuli all kind of mix together to inform whatever behavior they engage in. So we understand that, like, if there's a problem and they're not responding the way we expect, we got to stop and change. We got to switch what we're doing. You know, we kind of blame our instruction, not the learner. We never blame the learner. The learner is always right. They're just doing what they've learned or what the environment is selecting.
Yeah, and you just hit on the learner always being right, the environment. Ecology is a big component of applied behavior analysis, understanding the culture and understanding the expectation of that culture and what has been learned. And how do you make sure that, I mean, you're able to adapt or you're able to utilize precision teaching across a variety of diverse communities, knowing that, you know, and maybe it is that the science stays the same, but you're looking at mm-hmm. how I teach might be different or what I'm teaching might be different in different places. How do you make sure that you can see kind of the application of it across diverse communities?
One of the things that I do is, sometimes what we have is we have performance standards or aims. These are like levels of performance that we want to hit, which usually result in fluency. If we, for instance, are in an environment where, let's say I'm working with a student who's Jewish and their parents want them to learn to be able to read. So that the characters in the Torah are not the same in English. So what we would do is we would say, okay, let's see what a fluent performer does. Ask the parents, let's see how fast you read. And then we'll set that as the aim. And then we'll work with your kid to be able to reach that aim, because we don't already maybe have one. So we're looking at fluent performers in this culture, in this environment. And we're saying, well, if that's what fluency looks like for them, maybe it can look like that for you. So let's try that. And then if that works, that's great. Sometimes they need to go further and higher and hit a higher level of fluency, sometimes called super fluency, to be able to reach the same level as their parent. But this is a way that we can make sure that even if we don't have the standard within the literature, we can find an individual in the culture and we can have them help us learn how to get their learner to where they need to be.
I wonder if there's any research or any future research that's going to be done and being able to evaluate, because, I mean, you talk about fluency, and one of the things I might be thinking of is language fluency, mm-hmm. and that the pace of language oftentimes changes based off of, you know, the language, the dialect, and all that. Is there any research kind of helping to guide that, you know, is that the fluency rate for this sort of language might be in this range? I mean, is there anything that people are looking at that way?
Yes, actually, right behind me, I have two books that describe those aims. One from my advisor, the Precision Teaching book, has a lot of different aims for fluency of, you know, rate of speech, for fluency for math facts, fluency for reading. And this book as well, Weaving Love and Science in Educational Practice by Clay Starlin. I think that one's a good book too. And it has aims as well, but different languages are going to have different rates of fluency. Because, you know, the phonemes might be different, the words might be longer, shorter, the way you pronounce them. There's a whole lot of variables, so they don't always transfer over perfectly. So there's a lot of research into, okay, so what's this language's level to reach fluency? And there's a lot of research out there on it. If you look into precision teaching and just type in what you're interested in, there has been a gap in the literature, I would say, because in 2012, the Journal of Precision Teaching stopped. It doesn't exist after that. So fewer publications came out. And a lot of times for the space in a journal, they don't want to use a standard acceleration chart because they say it takes up too much space in a paper journal. So I heavily disagree. I don't think that's a good reason to not publish important science, but there's incredible research done if you look for it. People just, you know, they just don't know.
No, and then that's maybe where I'd be asking you is what would you hope is going to be either the future of precision teaching, what we need to be looking at deeper within precision teaching, or maybe even, you know, the utopic world of adaptation of precision teaching in what environments. Where do you see this going? Where would you hope it goes?
Okay, well, precision teaching has been around since like the 70s. I've been around since 92. So I can tell you that, like, you know, the growth has kind of stagnated over a long period of time after a while. But I would hope that people hear me and others talk about precision teaching, especially in areas and ways that are more accessible. Sometimes it's not as easy. The response effort is a little high when it comes to articles or books. But if I make a 1.5 minute TikTok or an Instagram reel talking about it, the barrier to entry might not be as difficult. If there are YouTube or podcasts on precision teaching, the barrier to entry isn't as high. And I would hope that more people would be interested and intrigued in precision teaching and be like, let me look into it. Ideally, I wouldn't say that everything ever needs to be charted on the standard acceleration chart, but I think that most behavior should be and could be. I would like to go away from using percent correct or percent opportunity occurrence. you can kind of spell that one out, because it's just, it leaves so much information on the table. Like, imagine Shaq at the free throw line. If he has 100% free throw for that day, but he only made one, I mean, that's misleading, you know, and it doesn't tell the whole story. We should be using frequency count over time. And I would like to see everybody use that, because we can then compare different behaviors on the same chart, different learners on the same chart, learners in the different environments on the same chart. You can chart all performance on the same chart and compare it across all performers, environments, reinforcers, whatever. And to me, that's amazing, because you can't really do that with a non-standard line graph. I mean, what if it goes too high and the numbers of behavior is just too high? You need to add pieces of paper. You know, it's kind of when you look more into it, just like, you know what, this kind of makes sense. And what I would like to tell people is, the thing that got me into precision teaching in the chart was one of my professors in my master's program, Dr. Eric Carlson. He said that he worked at Morningside Academy, which is somewhere where they use a lot of precision teaching. And he said, I could tell that a kid was getting sick before they would get sick by the measures on the standard acceleration chart. They started dropping in frequency and, like, oh, yep, that kid's going to be sick tomorrow. Next day, they didn't show up. And I'm like, oh, my God, this chart is so sensitive. You can detect that. I got to check something out. I got to check this out, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that there's so much application that could be occurring outside of the world of academics or outside of the world of treatment, where even in the business world or OBM, is that you can utilize these same concepts, and it's just getting it more mainstream. I'd almost challenge to say is that right now, as behavior analysts, learn the concept of acceleration chart, but the application in day-to-day life or treatment, it's kind of glossed over. And that's a piece that I think that if we enhance, that we'd see more of that during the education of our clinicians.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that before you go on, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Dr. Carl Binder, who uses like what he learned from precision teaching in the business world and OBM. And he's just this incredible dude. I took his seminar on performance management last year. And he was actually B.F. Skinner's student, and he knows so much. And he was told by Ogden Lindsley, he was kicked out of precision teaching and education and pushed into the employment and business world, because like, we need you over here. And then when it comes to like sports, there's a lot of people using the standard acceleration chart with sports. One of the things that I did is Steph Curry. I'm a Warriors fan. So Steph Curry, best shooter of all time. He was shooting and he made like 105 threes in about 5 minutes. So I charted it on a standard acceleration chart and I saw that he was making about 20 per minute. So to be able to shoot like Steph Curry, you need to be able to make 20 three-pointers per minute for 5 minutes. And then you can have his fluency. You could be like him. I mean, it shows on the chart.
Yeah, I mean, you got it in the business world, in the clinical world, sports psychology. I mean, it's a little bit of everywhere. Performance is performance. And what, I mean, you gave so many resources. Is there anything else that you just want to make sure people have their eyes on, or different resources that people can turn to be able to educate themselves more?
So when it comes to being able to educate yourself more on precision teaching, there's definitely go to celeration.org. That's where the Standard Celeration Society exists. They have a conference every year, and it's basically where all the big precision teaching information and learning occurs. If you YouTube precision teaching, you'll come up with a few things. And then also, if you want to learn, if you want to have somebody come to your company to teach your employees or you, you can look into Octave Innovation. If you have a kid that has trouble with motor development, daily living, language, and vocational skills, I would recommend Agile Instruction and Management Solutions, AIMS. They're really good with that. They've done marvelous things. Morningside Academy uses the chart. They are able to do incredible things, not only using the chart, but a whole bunch of other stuff. And I did their summer teachers program last year. And when I tell you, I learned so much stuff, like every single day, my brain was hurting, but in a good way. Those are some places. I think I gave a few books. And then there are some articles about like the Big Six Plus Six. Actually, yes. If you Google Big Six Plus, the plus symbol six, you'll come up with this article by the Autism Helper that talks about the Big Six Plus Six and how these small little behaviors reach, touch, point, I think it's reach, point, touch, grasp, place, release, and then twist, pull, push, tap, squeeze, shake. These behaviors are required to like button and unbutton your shirt, to be able to put on clothes. And a lot of times we use backwards and forwards chaining in behavior analysis, and sometimes it doesn't work or it takes too long. And when people become fluent in these Big Six Plus Six skills, all of a sudden they're able to do it. They're able to wash their hands. They're able to do all these skills just because that one skill was disfluent. So yeah.
I mean, education is empowering, and having more tools in your belt is always going to make you better at what you're doing. But Jared, I appreciate you coming on, because I think this is something that putting it out there and being able to talk more about it, I think will expand curiosity and hopefully drive people to get educated on it more and more frequently. So thank you for giving us your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.